Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at three or four subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Benjamin Barber, the author of Jihad versus McWorld and The Truth of Power, Intellectual Affairs in the Clinton White House. We'll be talking about the apparent disarray amongst the Democrats in terms of an opposition as George W. Bush pushes through a tax cut that essentially gives bribes the American people with a $300 refrigerator at the expense of the future of the environment, the possibility of some kind of health care, prescription drugs, and other needed government services. We were talking about the apparent passivity of the American people in accepting this extraordinary canard and con. And I'm not even being remotely objective here. Then we'll speak with Mark Weisbrot, who's a co-director of the Center for Economic Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He's just returned from Venezuela. He has a large opinion piece in today's Washington Post about the stalemate in Venezuela. And we'll also talk with James Fellows, who's the national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. He has an article in it about the military-industrial complex revisited. We'll look at the military-industrial complex in terms of George W. Bush's contribution to it. And then finally, we'll speak with David Cole, who's the president of the Center for Auto Research in Detroit. We'll be talking about the SUV wars as a West Side group here in Los Angeles have embarked upon the Detroit project, featuring television commercials equating SUV owners with supporters of terrorism. And we'll be getting a reaction from Detroit and also finding out more about how Detroit, along with the Bush administration, are joining forces to defeat the California initiative to reduce greenhouse gases and mandate vehicles with alternative energy sources such as hybrid or hydrogen fuel cell. And in fact, we'll talk about the least discussed aspect of alternative fuel, and that is direct hydrogen, or otherwise known as H2ICE. Let's begin with Ben Barber. I'm speaking with Ben Barber, who is the author of Jihad versus McWorld and The Truth of Power, Intellectual Affairs in the Clinton White House. And Ben, as you've probably heard, I'm abandoning all pretexts of objectivity. I've launched into a tirade in the beginning about how it's extraordinary that the American people could be conned for as little as $300 to buy a refrigerator at the expense of the future of the environment, any possibility of rational and comprehensive health care and prescription drug coverage for seniors, and all of the things that were debated and discussed in the last presidential race. So,
good morning. I think your opening tirade was so depressing that most of your listeners are going to get back into bed and sleep through the rest of the day.
Well, it's their country, and they're going to have to live with the consequences.
No doubt. I'm afraid the Democratic Party is already back in bed and hasn't woken up for a couple of years, maybe not since the Supreme Court snatched the election away from the Democrats at the turn of the millennium. And there's real evidence that the Democratic Party is in deep disarray, that the putative candidates for the election that's going to be getting underway very soon for the presidency in 2004 are fearful of saying almost anything that would damage their chances to, by offending somebody, to be in line for the nomination. And I really think the larger problem for America today is not what Bush is doing, but what the Democrats are not doing. I mean, by that I mean that the Republicans at least have a point of view and have a philosophy, and those of us who are progressives and liberals and Democrats are fairly appalled by it, but at least they have the courage of their convictions, pushing ahead strongly with both an international policy and a domestic policy, or around coherent, if appalling, principles. Whereas the Democrats, on the other hand, seem to stand more or less for nothing but a vague opportunism, and it's not even very opportunistic because there's no indication that by being cowardly and refusing to take positions, they're actually winning themselves the approval of the American public. So I think the most discouraging thing about America right now is the absence of a two-party system, is the absence of a national debate. I mean, here we are today with 150,000 troops poised around Iraq and ready to go to war, and we still haven't had a meaningful debate about the war in Iraq, about the evidence the United States supposedly possesses that shows that the in saying that Iraq isn't developing weapons. Here we have an administration that's putting forward, as you said in your opening, proposals, almost all of whose benefits will go to the very rich and few of whose benefits will go anywhere else, and create further budget gaps in an already difficult situation, and in which even Republican governors are saying the states are going to be thrown even further into crisis, since the budget crisis is a greater issue for the states than for the federal government. And again, the opposition is doing and saying almost nothing. So, I mean, that to me really does suggest the problem, not what the Republicans are doing, but what the Democrats are not doing.
And in terms of the Democratic field running for president, it's getting more and more crowded. I think we're up to about 8 now, aren't we?
Yes, we are, and growing and counting. And, you know, we talk about the pygmies and the little guys and the midgets and so on. And I'm afraid what we're seeing right now is not so much people who themselves lack a history and lack a biography and lack principles, but people unwilling to talk about those issues, and unwilling to take any risks, and unwilling to put themselves out there in a strong kind of leadership way. I mean, the only man that's probably not true is our friend from Vermont, who has little to lose.
Howard Dean.
That he's going to win, so that Howard Dean is the only one who's shown some real courage here, but is likely to be the noisy but otherwise unattended candidate in the race.
Mm. But I don't think he's got much of a chance nationally. I mean, his main accomplishments that the governor of Vermont have been to bring about same-sex marriage, which I don't know that has.
Well, no, precisely. And my point is that as they are distanced from any possibility of winning, only to that degree do they speak out. And as they come closer to some chance at power, they become silent, invisible, cowardly, and timorous. And that, of course, creates a situation in which we really have one-party government in the United States, and that's a disaster, never mind for the near term in terms of world peace and the American budget and the American people, but it's a long-term disaster for democracy in America.
Well, one of the things that we've discussed in the past, Ben Barber, is the fact that the American left is manifestly weak, and one of the reasons it is because it has become a meaningless stew of identity politics. Is it possible that identity politics will sink the Democrats before they even get off first base?
Because
let me just run through the list here of some of these candidates. If Howard Dean drains the gay and lesbian vote, if Al Sharpton takes the African American vote, I'm trying to think of the rest of them.
It sort of the other way around, Ian. I mean, what I see is that in the absence of any clear unifying vision of America in the world, of an American form of social justice which includes all Americans of all races and so on, identity politics is a kind of residual game, and that's what gets played. So it's not so much that identity politics has robbed us of more unifying forms of democratic progressivism, as that the absence of any progressive vision leaves us nothing but identity politics. So, of course, the Sharptons and the Deans and so on are able to, you know, make their case because nobody else is making more of a case. So, I don't think it's so much a matter of the Democrats having done themselves in either through the DLC or, on the other hand, through a kind of postmodern identity politics, as it is simply not being willing to work hard and do the kind of work that the Republicans did in the 1960s when they went into the wilderness and they founded think tanks like the American Enterprise Institute and Norman Potteritz and Crystal Senior founded journals in which they really took up the question of what it might mean to be a conservative and a libertarian conservative of the kind that gave rise in time to laissez-faire neoliberalism, dribble-down economics, and the notion that the Democratic government was the enemy, not the friend of the American people. And that at least was a position. It's a dead wrong position, but it's a strong position. It's a position that's made a lot of headway with the American people. They did their homework. They came back. It got them elected in the Reagan years, and then got George Bush Sr. elected and got his son elected as well. And Clinton didn't really do much to protest that vision of the world, particularly when he said, as we remember back in 1996, I guess it was, in his State of the Union speech, that this is the end of the era of big government. You know, everybody's waiting for him to say, this is the end of the year of big business. Instead, he said, it's the end of the year of big government, leaving big business to the field. And the Federal Communications Act of 1996, passed by the Clinton administration, was an act that, as we know, turned over the new technologies and the Internet and the media to the private sector and said, in effect, the state Democratic government, the American people, no longer have a public utility in their own media and communications technologies. And we've seen the consequences of that in a commercialized, consumerist, pornographic Internet and media that no longer have any public responsibilities at all.
And Ben Barber, are these polls accurate, though? I mean, the president's own ratings, maybe it's just the world that I live in, but I've never met anybody that supports him. And the polls that indicate that the American people are in favor of this war, except if they're asked the right questions, you come with come out with a very different outcome. I mean, what?
Well, look, Paul, you know, there's two sets of problems. I mean, there's a serious problem with polls. Polls are so geared to the ways in which questions are asked, so that, for example, if you say, is Saddam a bad guy, most Americans say, yeah, he's a bad guy. If you said, should he be removed, most people say yes. If they say, should he be removed even by war, they say yes. But then if you ask them, yeah, but should he be removed by a war in which the United States goes in unilaterally and doesn't consult the UN, still today the majority of Americans say no. You know, so it's that too. But on the other hand, what you said, you know, does suggest we should be careful. I mean, here in the Upper West Side of New York and there in the parts of Los Angeles, you know, where many of your listeners reside, I dare say we don't hear a lot of what, you know, people elsewhere in the country are thinking and saying. We have to be very careful of our own kind of coastal biases. On the other hand, there's a lot of evidence that I've seen that suggests as you move away from the coast, there's also a diminishing interest in foreign interventions and greater suspicion of what this war may cost. So that in this particular case, it's not that coastal bias that you and I have to worry about, but the fact that the pollsters themselves are really not looking at what an awful lot of Americans in the heart of America, in Iowa and Nebraska and Tennessee and Arkansas, are thinking. And they are thinking, as they always have, that American troops shouldn't really be at risk abroad unless there's a direct threat to the United States. And an awful lot of Americans, I think, are wondering what exactly the direct threat is that Saddam Hussein poses, particularly if he supposedly possesses, without atomic weapons, a greater threat to the United States than North Korea with atomic weapons is supposed to represent. And why it is that we are making nice and having meetings with Bill Richardson and the UN representatives of North Korea, and why the president's saying with Powell, don't worry, we can talk to the North Koreans, where he's insisting that only war and the removal by force of Saddam Hussein is likely to change Iraq, is a question I think that an awful lot of Americans have. And I think if pollsters were to ask the right questions, they would feel that the American people are by no means united around the possibility of war, and that the president is on very thin ice here. But again, it takes full and expressive opposition to bring that out, to be saying things that American people can latch on to. And as long as the leadership, all Democrats and Republicans alike, seems to support the president, it's very hard for Americans to latch on with their suspicions and uncertainty to something firm that allows them to say, you know, maybe this war isn't such a good idea.
Well, finally, Ben Barber, back to the original puzzlement, though. Are the American people so credulous that they could be bribed and beguiled by a $300, you know, with which you could buy a new refrigerator, as I say, at the expense of long-term environmental health care, prescription drugs, you name it, in terms
of... No, I think they are not that credulous, and there's a lot of evidence that where the Bush administration has the most to worry about and the most to lose is its wan or non-support for environment, its refusal to acknowledge global warming as a reality. I think most Americans care deeply about the environment. It touches them where they live and the places they live, the water and the air that their children have to breathe and drink. And I think that's an area, in fact, in which the Republicans and this administration are particularly vulnerable, and one, again, which one wonders why are the Democrats not openly exploiting this and making a fuss about it. And so, my feeling is the American people are incredulous at the Bush attack on the environment, suspicious of the new budget cuts and the tax cuts for the rich, and unwilling to be all-out enthusiastic supporters for a war in Iraq, but the leadership that should be representing those positions and giving them a firm basis to kind of say, yes, that's how we feel, is simply not there, which leaves the American people, those who are suspicious of what Bush is doing, really without leadership, and makes it very, very hard, particularly in the face of the media's ongoing, unthinking, uncritical flag-waving for the administration on all of these questions, leaves the American people really without anything to latch on to. And I think that's the problem.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Ben Barber.
Pleasure to be with you, Ian.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Ben Barber, who is the author of Jihad versus McWorld and The Truth of Power, Intellectual Affairs in the Clinton White House. I'm now speaking with Mark Weisbrot, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. And Mark, just in the last month of December, 101,000 more Americans lost jobs. How can the Bush administration get away with this tax cut for the rich in the face of growing indications that we're heading into a recession, unemployment is growing in leaps and bounds, and the best argument they can come up with is, oh, you can't criticize them, otherwise it's class warfare?
Yes, well, I think I only caught a little bit of what Ben was saying, but I think the problem is that the press looks overwhelmingly to the leadership of the Democratic Party for opposition. It doesn't report opposition in general unless it comes from them. And so you get still a fairly one-sided view of these things. Now, you did have Nancy Pelosi this time denouncing the tax cut and others too. So I think he actually is not going to get the dividend tax cut, I would imagine. But nonetheless, the Democratic leadership has not been strong or forceful enough, even with this response, to get something in there that even the chair of the chief economist at Goldman Sachs was saying, you know, he favors the Democratic stimulus. He thinks they should have even more. It should go into 2004. That's what he said in the paper the other day. Now, so even the smarter elements of the CEOs and big business recognize that the economy is very weak right now, that it's very likely heading into a recession, and it actually does need a stimulus from their point of view, and they can't even get a voice.
Well, the stimulus or the lack of stimulus in this package, it's the reverse of stimulus, because it's just eating a giant hole into the federal debt or creating a massive federal debt. And I understand that even the one aspect of it that everybody seems to think is okay, and that is the so-called double taxation on dividends, that it turns out that it's not in fact going to benefit most shareholders, the very middle class shareholders that Bush is claiming to be giving relief to.
No, that's right, and it was very misleading. And most of the press didn't pick up on this, although some of them did because we told them about it. The dividend tax cut applies to only a small fraction of people who hold stock in the United States.
The most wealthy.
The most wealthy, because most people, first of all, half the people don't hold any stock at all, even through retirement accounts. But of the half that do, the vast majority of those people hold their stock in retirement accounts, like 401ks, and those will not be affected by the dividend tax cut at all, because by removing the tax on dividends, because if you're holding a retirement account, basically the you pay the tax on the retirement income when you retire, so you're going to still be paying a tax on any dividend income that was accumulated while you're holding that account. So you're not affected at all. You don't get anything out of it. And that's why this cut is so concentrated that even the first year of it, the 2003 version of it, less than 8% of it goes to 60% of the population.
Well, I mean, so it's a double con. One, the idea that you can bribe people with $300 and they can give away the store and their future and mortgage it all for $300. And on top of that, it turns out that the most advertised aspect of this tax cut, the relief on so-called double taxation on dividends, is a fraud.
It is pretty much, and it's the most expensive part of it, too. It's the majority of the whole thing is projected by Treasury to cost about $670 billion over 10 years, and the $360 billion of that is, in fact, the dividend part of it. And so that's why it's overwhelmingly skewed towards, I mean, the whole 10-year thing, the majority of it would go to people with incomes of over $1 million a year. So it is really outrageous. I don't think he's going to get away with this one, but he shouldn't even have a chance, and there shouldn't be a compromise. I mean, there really should be a stimulus plan, which, of course, wouldn't be a 10-year rewriting of the tax code. It would be something that is injected into the economy right now, you know, spending, you know, for the states, for example, for California, money for the states so they don't have to cut back spending and raise taxes, as California and other states are doing massively by billions of dollars. This is, you know, the state and local economies are 12% of the U.S. economy. State and local governments are 12% of the U.S. economy.
And most of them are in the red.
And they're in the red.
And most of them are cutting their social services as a way to make up for the deficits.
That's right. And they waited until after the November election to do this. And so this is another smack that the economy is taking right at the time when the war with Iraq will, probable war, and will cause massive uncertainty. If they do go to war, it'll be very much like September 11th, much worse in the sense that the economy was already in recession then, and then the uncertainty created by the attacks, the terrorist attacks, caused business investment and consumer spending to drop enormously. And this is what would happen with a war. And so I think and you've already got, as you said, the jobs report on Friday looked very dismal. The economy lost 101,000 jobs in December, and since President Bush took office, actually the economy has lost 1.6 million jobs, and the private sector has lost 2.3 million jobs. That is, the public sector expansion has partly made up for the loss of the private sector jobs, but that's still an enormous amount of jobs lost since January 2001. So the whole the economy looks very weak by any current measure or forecasted measure, and this is what we're heading into, and the administration is just once again, amazingly enough, just trying to take advantage of it to rewrite the tax code and not providing any significant stimulus to the economy.
So, Mark Weisbrot, what are they doing? Are they paying off the wealthy supporters, or are they, don't they want to get reelected? I mean, I don't understand why they could be so flagrantly cynical and just raid the treasury on the behalf of the wealthy.
Well, you know, I really, that's always a tough call when someone does something this outrageous. Obviously, they think they can get away with it. They've gotten away with an awful lot. If the Democrats never mount a significant challenge to them, they could conceivably get away with it. You have to remember, the leadership of the Democratic Party right now has primarily fought against them on the grounds of fiscal conservatism. They've said, you know, the 2001 tax cut, they opposed it not primarily because of its redistributive effect, but their main point, and the one that they might even try again in the next year or so, is that it adds to the deficit. And that's not a very compelling argument, because first of all, in a time of recession, you know, you do want the deficit to expand. That's, any economist will tell you that. Secondly, the deficit spending is not that great. That's caused by the tax cut. And in fact, most of the increase, you know, the economy has gone from a surplus to a deficit from last year. And that's mostly due to loss in revenues, and not loss in revenues due to capital gains revenues going down to the slowing of the economy, and not really overwhelmingly due to the tax cut. So the major arguments that the Democratic leadership have used to oppose these policies have been false, or positioning themselves to the right of the Republicans. And that, I think, has been a losing strategy, and I hope that they're going to change that now.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Mark Weisbrot, who is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. And Mark has an extensive article in today's Washington Post about Venezuela, where you were just down in Caracas, and you witnessed the extraordinary paralysis and polarization in that country, where there has been long-standing demonstrations against Hugo Chavez on the part of the wealthy and the middle class, and counter-demonstrations on the part of his core supporters amongst the poor. And, of course, there's now a general strike, and the oil is not flowing, and it's the second biggest oil supplier to the United States. I believe, a friend of mine was just down there a few weeks ago, was absolutely appalled at the way that the media is, in fact, driving this polarization. Commercial media apparently runs the most virulent, outrageous stuff that, you know, beyond belief in terms of its flagrant propaganda. And of course, the government station is equally propagandistic. So is the media really driving this potential civil war?
Well, yes, it's a huge part of it. And even the term middle class is a little bit exaggerated, because it's really the upper quintile or so that is the base of opposition to the government. And that's why, you know, very simply, that's what's going on in Venezuela, is these people have lost five elections now since 1998 because they don't have a majority, anywhere near a majority of the population, and they can't win. And that's why Chavez was elected and re-elected, and the Constitution was approved and everything else. And so what they're doing is they're pursuing their goals by or extra-legal means. They tried a military coup in April, and that failed, and they had the support of the United States, and it still failed, and partly because they didn't anticipate all the thousands and tens of thousands of people that came out into the streets and risked their lives, and some of them were shot, to defend democracy. And so now they're trying to make the country ungovernable, and they're doing that primarily through an oil strike. And that's important too, because it's not really a general strike as reported in the press. If you actually see the place, it's really almost exclusively the oil workers, which is a tiny fraction of the labor force, but a very powerful one, that are on strike. Now, the role of the media here is crucial, because in any other country in the world, except for, you know, Burma or someplace where there's a controlled media, people would turn against the strikers because, after all, they don't have any legitimate grievance against the government. And more importantly, people are sitting and waiting in miles-long gas lines on the highways. People would get tired, but what they see all day long on all five broadcast stations, and of course there's one government channel, but the five broadcast stations are the equivalent of, you know, CBS and NBC and ABC and Fox here, and there's not much cable. And all day long they play anti-government propaganda, and not just propaganda, but they even make things up. So they accuse the president of responsibility for murder, for example, even when they don't have any evidence. And this is what people see all day. And so I think this has an influence. Now, you know, the 35% or so that are strong supporters of Chavez just don't even watch don't pay as much attention to the broadcast TV. But all the people in the middle, I think, are very much affected by this. So it is a big issue. And I tell you, even while I was down there, the international press, which is very prejudiced also against Chavez, even they were disgusted with the Venezuelan media, and they had a meeting with the owners of the TV stations there, and they scolded them for acting like this. And the owners just said, you know, you guys went after the United States government during Watergate, and that's what we're doing here. They didn't really get it.
Well, I would have thought Whitewater would have been a better example. But, anyway, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Mark Weisbrot.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Mark Weisbrot, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and he has an extensive article in today's Washington Post about Venezuela and the polarization and paralysis there. I'm now speaking with James Fellows, who's the national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. And in the current issue of The Atlantic Monthly, he revisits President Eisenhower's farewell address, where the phrase military-industrial complex was first coined. James Fellows, I understand, though, in an earlier draft of that speech, the phrase was the military-industrial congressional complex, and out of deference to the Congress and on the advice of his brother Milton Eisenhower, President Eisenhower took that phrase out.
There's a very interesting sort of historical sleuthing issue that's come up here that I don't actually know the answer to, because by wild chance, I ended up talking a couple of days ago to the man who actually was Eisenhower's speechwriter for this speech. Now, who would have thought he was still around? And he said there were sort of two contending theories. He's not sure which one is really true, whether it was military-industrial congressional complex or military-industrial scientific complex, that Eisenhower at different times had considered both of those, and for the reasons you mentioned of various sensitivities, both in the Congress and the and big science, they boiled it down to military-industrial.
Well, I know at Los Alamos, for example, the main buildings there were built in the Eisenhower period, and they were built deliberately built cheaply, because President Eisenhower sent the directive down saying that, you know, I don't want a permanent complex here. You know, this is a temporary situation, this nuclear paralysis. I mean, was he ever wrong? But
right. And it is quite amazing to go back through some of the I'm going to use the term legislative history. I don't mean that. Sort of the intellectual history of Eisenhower's coming up with this proposal, because clearly this is a man who was speaking from bitter experience, the experience of fighting the military budget in the decade, the 15 years after World War II, in which he'd fought, and seeing how powerful the momentum was to keep things going.
And he was actually fighting Democrats. He was fighting Symington. He was fighting Scoop Jackson, Lyndon Johnson. They were the ones that were ladling the pork.
Indeed. And many members of his own party were still in a sort of the parsimonious conservative stage, a camp of which there are a few representatives in this era.
Well, we've got Duncan Hunter and Kurt Weldon now, key people in the Congress, and Tom DeLay, and et cetera. They just can't wait to pour money into their districts. But that's why I think the omission of the military-industrial congressional complex has not served us well, because clearly when you look at every effort on the part of the Department of Defense to rationalize its own budget, guess who stops them? It's the Congress people.
That certainly is true. And there's been a kind of ripple effect corruption within the uniformed military. It's interesting that when Rumsfeld, during his nearly year as a pre-war secretary, when he was still Secretary of Defense as opposed to Secretary of War, he was in certain ways trying to rationalize the budget. And the two opponents he ran into were, of course, the Congress, because any cut in spending means jobs out of somebody's district, and the uniformed military, which had learned in the time since Eisenhower that essentially the duty of the Pentagon was to keep contracts moving through. You know, it is essentially a huge contracting headquarters more than anything else, and so attempts to get some control of it have the sort of military congressional pincer to oppose.
Well, indeed, the pundits in Washington were already writing Rumsfeld's obituary prior to 9/11. And 9/11, in fact, sort of rescued him, didn't it?
Oh, very, very much so. I mean, in terms of, if you want to take the high road explanation, you could say it's a task that better suits his talents, because clearly he is reveling the role he now has. As a sort of Washington sociology, it made him look like a, quote, winner as opposed to a quote, loser. But the interesting point here, I think, is that what was making him seem a loser before was a new kind of complex, the military congressional press complex, of sort of sending out these leaks about how Rumsfeld didn't know what he was doing, was getting crosswise of the army, et cetera, et cetera.
And let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with James Fellows, who's the national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly, and there's an article of his in the current issue which revisits President Eisenhower's farewell address, where he first coined the phrase military-industrial complex. And now, of course, we have an adjunct to the military-industrial complex, the Homeland Security, which so far, from what I can tell, we use $38 billion for a color code, and in many ways, I think you could rename the Homeland Security Act as the Inconvenience Americans at Airports Act.
Indeed. And I was actually at some big budgetary seminar just a couple of days ago where people were going through the net effect of the changes in the budget for the military and for the Homeland Security Department in the last year and a half. And most of the Homeland Security spending, you know, looking at purely budgetary authority, has been for sort of larger versions of what we were doing before. You know, the airline security bureaucracy is much bigger and more cumbersome. The Coast Guard is getting a little more money, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, the main change in American life because of the Homeland Security Act and apparatus is partly the inconvenience that you mentioned and partly the change in sort of the general balance, burden of proof in legal matters, you know, for, in ways that people are you know, from detaining prisoners to whatever. That's been a much more dramatic change than anything in the budget.
But isn't it operating along the same lines as the military industrial complex in terms of contracting? If you can come up with something that will either create some security for the American people in the homeland or create the illusion of security, you can sell it.
Very much so. And this has there's been a very interesting sort of coincidence with the trends in the tech economy, because one part of the Homeland Security thrust feeds exactly into what the civilian tech economy has been working on over the last decade, from search tools, information processing tools, giant databases, ways to go through those and do pattern recognition much more quickly, and sensing technology. And at just the time when the civilian customers for those products are all going broke or drying up, and the sort of civilian business demand has been very weak for the last 2 years, suddenly there is there's the government has this security demand for many of the same techniques. And so to go to tech industry conferences these days is to see, you know, tremendous attention on, they're essentially defense contractor conventions now, because the government is the big buyer now for the tech industry.
I've been told that the CIA is one of the biggest presences now in Silicon Valley.
It's true, because as a customer, they are buying when, for example, the airlines, which used to be big tech customers, are not buying, and other places. Also, the CIA has now a venture capital arm. And when normal venture capitalists are sitting on their hands, sitting on their money, the CIA's group is sitting out, you know, venture stakes in various info processing companies.
But again, why didn't Eisenhower's speech get more traction? I mean, it's sort of the military industrial complex is kind of a buzzword that's relegated to the left as a critique, a kind of knee-jerk critique of the Pentagon. But it didn't come from a leftist. It came from one of the most distinguished American generals and presidents.
Well, you know, one hypothesis, I think that it's a very good question, and I would hypothesize two answers. One is that during the Vietnam era, or say from the Dr. Strangelove era through the Vietnam era, the connotation of military-industrial complex changed away from what Eisenhower meant. I argue in this article that what Eisenhower meant is the same situation we're in now, where this complex is mainly for spending money rather than getting into wars. The modern U.S. military doesn't really want to get into wars. It wants to buy weapons, but not necessarily go out and use them in battle. And in the Dr. Strangelove and Vietnam era, when you said military-industrial complex, what you were thinking of was essentially warmongering. And so there was a kind of Curtis LeMay shift of the meaning from what Eisenhower had in mind. I think the other reason is that there is actually an interesting long pattern, in at least in modern American history, of military veterans, military statesmen being the main voices of caution about military spending. Certainly we see that in the case of Colin Powell now, and they are the ones who sort of get most resistance from conservatives who want to keep the spending going. And we see that with the battle between Powell and the Republican right wing now, and also the embarrassment among Republicans about the military-industrial complex speech.
Well, there's no question that not only are they averse to war. I mean, we actually have set the standard with the Kosovo war of the Immaculate War, where no Americans die.
And similarly, during the buildup, since the beginning of last year, since say last spring when Iraq began to seem like a genuine possibility, the main source of opposition within the national government in the U.S. was the military. It wasn't the Democratic Party. It was the uniformed military who was saying, hey, wait a minute, we're going to get stuck holding the bag here. We'll have a quick victory, and then we'll be there forever. Let's get some allies. And so it's a quite strange evolution from the Curtis LeMay era.
Well, it wasn't just the military, though. It was many of Bush senior's people, Baker, Schwarzkopf, Scowcroft, General Zinni, made some remarks off the cuff that were very, very interesting.
It's true, and I think it's significant that both General Scowcroft and General Zinni were speaking for this kind of voice of military caution, which combined with sort of the instinct of the senior Bush, James Baker type crowd of let's rope in some allies because things go much more easily that way.
Well, but we have a different president. I mean, some people describe President Bush's foreign policy as faith-based foreign policy, but he is evangelical and he is different from the father, and he does appear to be prepared to break the China.
Very, very much so, and I think that we are now entering. There was a very significant twist in this policy, say, 3 months ago, when the administration, despite everything you said and everything I would agree with, decided to go to the United Nations, and there was the 15-0 vote in the Security Council. In the last week, as Tony Blair has begun saying, hey, wait a minute, as the Turkish government has been saying, hey, wait a minute, as other people who had been sort of joining this cause have backed away from it, we're moving back towards a situation of last summer when the administration is having to decide, will they do this alone? You know, and again, the Democrats have been very slow. It'll be the military that is sort of more influential within the government of saying an unallied war will be difficult than with the Democratic Party.
Well, indeed, there's a blistering essay by Harold Pinter that's circulating, and I imagine it's making life very difficult for Tony Blair. I think the opposition is mounting in Europe and increasing. But on the other hand, it seems to me that much of what is happening now is a part of a bluff, and I think there's an expectation that maybe things that you'll have a Romanian type scenario with Ceausescu. You know,
that would certainly, you know, I don't want to sound as if I'm eager for bloodshed of any sort, but certainly from the Bush administration's point of view, and from any points of view, it would be easier if the job could be done internally than by invasion. I guess I don't know enough about sort of the nuanced internal politics of Iraq to know whether that's actually feasible, whether Hussein's grip is weakening enough that other people would take him out. I don't know. I think that would probably be more convenient if it happened, because then you could have some kind of allied occupation, including Arab allied occupation, without, you know, U.S. forces leading it.
Just in closing then, James Feller, going back to your article in the current issue of the Atlantic Monthly, when you say that the new military industrial complex is one about permanent war but no war, as opposed to warmongering, how can you sustain the illusion over a long term that you're actually doing something with all this money? Because one of the paradoxes about what Al-Qaeda and this future in the 21st century of death by a thousand cuts indicates that you cannot fight hatred with weapons, that this is a software problem that hardware does not solve.
I would agree with you, and I would say that, but if I were making the opposite case, I would think that almost any world circumstance could serve my needs. If there are further attacks, then you can argue, well, see, there's all the more need to have, you know, rapidly deployable forces to go root this out at its cause. And if there are not attacks, you can say, look, it's working. And why tamper with success? So I think that any course of world events can be used to justify the case for continuing and growing budgets.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, James Fellows.
My pleasure, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with James Fellows, who is the national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly, and in which he has an article in the current issue, and he's the former editor-in-chief of U.S. News and World Report. I'm now speaking with David Cole, who is the president of the Center for Auto Research in Detroit. And David Cole, I'm sure you're aware of the Detroit Project, which has originated here on the west side of Los Angeles, they've produced a couple of commercials which are running, although a lot of stations are refusing to take these commercials. I understand, though, from the Detroit Project's website is getting something like 1 million hits a day. So even though the front pages of the Detroit Free Press decried this, it seems to be that there's some support for this war on SUVs.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that there is. For some people, they've made it a crusade, And basically the essence of this is a few trying to tell others how they should run their lives. And, of course, they do this on the basis of whether it's issues of Iraq and the Middle East conflict or global warming. It's not a surprise that we have this kind of a movement.
And do you think there will be that Detroit will respond to it? I mean, or hunker down?
Well, I think Detroit is, as every manufacturer in the world is, and one of the very basic facts of life, and this is something that a great many people don't understand, is that a successful company, whether it's a European, an American, or a Japanese or a Korean company, has to provide products to the market is interested in, and that you can build and sell profitably. So the industry, literally on a worldwide basis, is building a range of products, whether it's very efficient small cars or small cars with hybrid power plants or very large vehicles that meet certain needs. For example, one of the new products that created a sensation at the Detroit Auto Show, the international show here in the past week in the press preview, was the Nissan full-size pickup truck, which you would hardly call a low-price, inefficient or efficient vehicle.
And how is it powered?
It's powered by an internal combustion engine, a very large one.
Hmm. So are the consumers going in the opposite direction from the anti-SUV activists?
Well, it's very mixed. We of course, during the 1990s, had a continuing explosion in the success of what we call light trucks. And light trucks include minivans, pickup trucks, and SUVs. And that market has continued to be extremely strong to the point where it is now over 50% of the vehicles sold in the country. And a manufacturer that decided to ignore those segments would be foolish.
Well, as a tactic to call SUV owners terrorists, there are obviously there are more extreme efforts being which I'm sure nobody wants to be associated with, such as burning SUVs in lots, etc. But as a tactic, it would seem odd that you try to persuade people by making them mad.
I think that's right, and consequently, I don't think it'll work. I think it's basically foolishness. It may influence some people, but a great many people drive vehicles because of their need. For example, my oldest son, his wife drives a full-size SUV. They have four children and two dogs, and the alternative is a pair of cars to do the same job.
But the point I was going to get to, though, David Cole, was that I don't understand how we've got into this either-or mutual exclusive argument. And in other words, it shouldn't be you either drive an SUV and ruin the environment, or you drive an electric car and save the environment. How about just changing the whole focus and saying, sure, people can have whatever car they want. They just have to power these cars with less polluting engines, and let's start talking about hydrogen.
Well, of course, it's a bit of a fantasy to talk about hydrogen now, because we really don't have an infrastructure or the capability of producing it economically. And what most people don't know is that the source of the hydrogen that we might use if we move to fuel cells or hydrogen-powered internal combustion engines for the foreseeable future would be natural gas and petroleum. Hydrogen is not easy to find. It's as by itself. It's easy to find in water and when it's combined with carbon and hydrocarbon fuels, but free hydrogen is just not there. And our ability to separate it from the compounds that are it's tied to, or to store it, transmit it, is very difficult. And just for example, in an internal combustion engine, the hydrogen is a terrific fuel. The problem has nothing to do with engine technology. It's our ability to create the hydrogen economically, to transport it, to store it, or whatever is necessary to bring it to the engine to power the vehicle.
So in theory, your engine actually runs better on hydrogen because it's essentially getting steam cleaned.
It's a clean fuel. Right. We still would have problems with oxides of nitrogen because that's related to a different process of high temperature in engines, but certainly carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide and unburned hydrocarbons would be non-existent in the exhaust of a hydrogen-fueled engine. I think one of the problems that we are seeing today is that there are pockets of support for just about everything you can think of, hybrids, diesels, fuel cells, and most of the people that are dealing with this or talking about it really don't know very much about what they're talking about and think that this idea is a great thing without really recognizing some of the practical limitations or the economic issues.
But
it's even true of, a vehicle choice. In a country that refuses to put much of a fuel tax on our fuel and has energy prices almost at record levels, of low levels, even today on a historic basis, why is it a surprise that the market likes larger, less fuel-efficient vehicles they think are more safe?
Right, but environmentalists would argue that the planet can't sustain this this situation.
I think that's true. I think everybody recognizes that, but at this point we're not in imminent danger of running out of petroleum. I think that as we sit here in Michigan in the winter, global warming doesn't have quite the meaning that it would have other places. It's certainly a critical issue, and I can tell you people across the auto industry are worried about it, but the basic fact is that if you're going to be successful as an industry, providing individual mobility to people, men and women across literally the world, you have to be able to design, develop, and build products that people want to buy. You have to be able to sell them at a profit. And that's what generates the return that enables the industry to look at the alternative power technologies. We've just been through this in the last few days in Detroit, where we saw hybrids, advanced diesels that are much cleaner than what many people think diesels are like. The range of power technologies that is being explored now actively by the industry is enormous, and it's extraordinarily expensive. Very few people have any idea of what the costs are associated with bringing this technology into place. And even if you look at it with some of the technologies that we have here today, an absolutely outstanding vehicle is the Toyota Prius, which uses a hybrid power plant. Toyota has acknowledged that that's starting to make a profit now, but that vehicle, compared to an equivalent vehicle that they make called the Echo, is about $7,000 more expensive. So the economics are not in place yet for most of these alternatives to justify major investment. When you start talking about powertrain facilities, you get to billions of dollars very, very quickly.
But David Cole, what would it take then to, if, for example, hydrogen, which doesn't produce CO2...
Well, hydrogen does produce CO2 if you use hydrocarbon as a fuel. You don't throw, as you separate hydrogen from the fuel, you don't throw the carbon away as lumps of coal. It's actually converted to CO2. You might have a better way to sequester it or to contain it in a way that wouldn't be released to the atmosphere.
But essentially the method to create hydrogen, the gas, and if we're talking about just putting the gas into the internal...
are very non-economic at the present time.
It's electrolysis.
Electrolysis is a beautiful way to do it. If you have very inexpensive nuclear power, for example, or solar power, electrolysis is a wonderful way, but it's with the present technology, the costs are just totally out of sight.
And even overnight, cheap electricity on the grid?
Well, where do you get the electricity on the grid?
Right.
Our country is an interesting country. We're free to express our ideas.
Right.
And one of the cleanest forms of power that we have, that we know about, and other people recognize it in the world, is nuclear power. And we talk about global warming, but we also are dead set, at least often the vocal minority is very dead set against things like nuclear power. And essentially the idea is that we should go back to horses.
Mm.
And without energy and energy conversion of the modern technology that we would have, our planet does not have the ability to sustain life today. We have to take advantage of this. So it's not just a convenient issue. It's one that's a matter of life and death, the conversion of energy and development of whether it's growing crops or what have you.
Well, but clearly you can make a very, very compelling argument that, look, the Mother Earth is telling us something, that we're really in trouble here. And two,
the other
aspect that David is that we're clearly in trouble in the Middle East. So if you, the broader question is, and it may be too idealistic, but you know, Jack Kennedy said in 10 years we'll get to the moon, and it seemed like a far-fetched thing. Could some national leaders make say, listen, we need to deal this, we need to get out of this quagmire in the Middle East, and we're going to have to start building infrastructure?
Well, to begin with, the Middle East issue, I think, is a bit of a fantasy. There is, if Iraq were taken out of the picture, there's still plenty of petroleum. And people are using this as an argument, but it is, it's a hollow argument. It doesn't mean anything. If you took the entire Middle East out, that would have an impact. But you may not be aware of it today, but even in Canada, the tar sands, which are an enormous source of potential petroleum, the costs now are less than $20 a barrel to create that. So the hydrocarbon reserves around the world in various forms are enormous. Now, you know, if we said economics are not an option, not a concern, we could develop a hydrogen economy, but I don't think the political leaders that support it that would be able to sustain their position of office because of the position of the tremendous sacrifice that we make economically to do it.
And you're saying that there's second-tier hydrocarbons that are accessible as well, even if
it's just a matter of economics. We pride ourselves on being in a market-based economy. And, you know, if you just remember a story that we learned a few years ago, back at the time of the Middle Eastern oil embargo, we had price controls and we had controls on the distribution. And then, if you remember, Ronald Reagan came into office and he removed those controls, and we had these dire predictions of $5 a gallon fuel and we wouldn't be able to find any. And what happened? We saw what happens when a free market works, and that is prices go down and the gas lines disappear. And that is the reality of the world that we live in. If we want to change the style to a command and control, as we saw in Russia and other places, we could do anything we wanted because economics would not be a consideration. But I don't think most people are willing to do this. We like to talk about things, but our ability to achieve some of these things is very difficult. As a scientist, and I've worked with power technology for nearly 40 years, I wish people would understand what the basic laws of thermodynamics are, that you convert energy from one form to another and you always create waste. Nobody has ever been able to do it otherwise. And we hear talk from people that have they don't know the difference between a law in the city and the laws of thermodynamics. The reality of this is very stark, and the technology is very difficult and it's very expensive, and there are no easy solutions.
But there is less. There's more waste than less waste.
If you let a free market operate, it does tend to gravitate towards less waste. But we live in a society that talks out of both sides of its mouth. We won't make fuel expensive, right? And why would we expect that people wouldn't go for abusive use of low-priced fuel? Even though they may not need a big car or truck, they drive it because there's no incentive not to, frankly, within the kind of a system that we have.
I thank you very much for we've run out of time, and I thank you very much for joining
us,
David.
Nice to talk to you, Ian.
Bye bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with David Cole, is the president of the Center for Auto Research. You can reach me at ianmasters@mail.com. Bye.